Hello, everyone. Megan Marie here, and this is episode 20 of the Crystal Habit Podcast. I love now that the game is out that we're able to get really deep into some of the cool features and systems in Tomb Raider. And this podcast is dedicated entirely to systems design and even further the emotional synchronization explored in Tomb Raider, which is something our senior systems designer Jonathan Hamill discussed recently at GDC, and you guys expressed some interest in hearing more about. So I will be joined by Jonathan, our senior software engineer Matt Gaston, and our principal animator Brandon Fernandez in just a moment to talk over these really cool systems and techniques used in the game to make you feel one with Lara. So we are here with three totally new guests today. I'm really excited because you guys know we kind of get stuck with the same people over and over again. And it's nice to have some fresh blood on the podcast. So here with me, I have senior systems designer Jonathan Hamill. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello.
And then senior software engineer Matt Gaston.
Hi.
Which we were just discussing that I think his last name is awesome. And principal animator Brandon Fernandez. Hello, Brandon.
How do you do?
Okay, so we're going to talk about something that I find particularly fascinating, the fans found really interesting when we did our little GDC breakdown. We're going to talk about emotional synchronization in Tomb Raider and systems design and all those cool things that go on in the background that you don't necessarily think about when you look at the pillars of combat and exploration and puzzle solving. There's all this other stuff going on that's equally fascinating. So first off, I like to do introductions anytime we have new people on. So, Jonathan, do you just want to kind of talk about what you do at the studio
sure.
and maybe something interesting you've done in the past, other studios or projects or so on?
Sure. Okay, so I was responsible for most of the gameplay systems in the game with a particular focus on the systems that weren't traversal in combat, so everything that had to do with hunting with Matt, at Matt Gaston, and salvage, survival skills, the weapon upgrades, retraversal, campsites, fast travel, weapon parts. What am I missing? Collectibles, relics, challenges.
See, look at all the stuff that was going on. Lots.
Persistence, yeah, a lot of stuff. Before this, I was at a company called Breakaway Games, where I worked on a lot of games that did not ship.
Oh.
That I can't talk about. Yeah, I know. That was very painful. And two things that did ship that I can talk about, which are Battle for Middle-earth 2, Rise of the Witch King, and Command & Conquer 3, Kane's Wrath.
Very cool. Yeah. How about you, Brandon?
So I was the lead animator on the project, as well as what we call a captain of the pet and enemy team, which, as Jonathan said, focused on the traversal and the enemies that was the only thing he didn't touch.
Yeah, we have a lot of we have a lot of acronyms in this. So if we start using,
well,
acronyms,
go ahead. What pet team? Break that down.
Did I say pet?
You said pet.
I meant to say player and enemy team. Yes.
See, no, that's interesting though. I mean, it was funny how long we went saying OMS before we actually explained what OMS was.
Yeah. And if I say herd, that's spelled H-U-R-D, which is hunting. Was it upgrades? Did we say? Yeah, hunting, upgrades, rewards, and depth team that I was a captain of that Matt was on. So herd and pet.
Insider information.
Yeah.
And so what did you do before Crystal or
I've been at Crystal for 13 years. It's my first job I had out of school. So
not bad.
Yeah.
Long run.
Yes. Started on Soul Reaver 2 and Legacy of Kain were the first two games I made here.
Mm-hmm. And how about for you, Matt?
So on this project, as a programmer, I worked on player traversal. I did a lot of the hunting and animal programming and some of the design for that, too, and boss fights.
Yeah. I remember one of the first meetings I ever came to, you were leading it, showing off hunting for the first time. Okay. So I saw the really early iteration of that and thought how cool that was and excited to see it in the game. So.
Yeah, Matt's a really good game designer as well as being an incredibly talented programmer. So it's double threat.
Aw.
That's very sweet.
Okay, so because systems designer is something that I don't think necessarily users may understand, consumers may understand, like, the crux of what that job is. Can you explain a little bit about that, Jonathan?
Yeah,
like, what is – you had this interesting quote in your presentation that you said your job is to make all the jumping and fighting meaningful.
Yeah,
you want to speak to that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I was trying to figure out how to work in a slide from James Bond from Skyfall into it, and they talk about, you know, all that jumping and fighting, it's exhausting, and it was just too good a fit to pass up. But I'm familiar with that unfamiliarity with systems design because my family doesn't really get it either. So often when I introduce myself to people, I'll say I'm a gameplay systems designer.
Mm-hmm.
So in design, there are definitely like tracks of people who do narrative design. They focus on what the story is going to be, or level design. They focus on the architecture. I use that word to like because people understand architecture. But the architecture of the spaces that the player moves through.
Mm-hmm.
And the gameplay systems designer designs how you play.
Mm-hmm.
How does health work? How what do you get? What are the pros and cons of the different choices a player can make? So a systems designer designs what the player can do, what their choices are, and also is responsible for making those choices meaningful choices.
Mm-hmm.
So why should I fight those enemies? Well, because I'm going to get something out of killing them that is something that I want.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the gameplay doesn't have any meaning. You're just going through these mechanical actions because the game designer told you that you have to do them.
Okay. And so the big question is, then what is emotional synchronization and why do we want it?
Got it. Okay. Well, so one of the things that we learned on this, or that I learned specifically on this project, was very much driven by Noah, who you've had on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea was very much inspired by conversations with him. But the idea is that in a first-person game, people have often said, "Well, we want to design a character who's a cipher so that the player can identify with the character." Or express themselves as the character. But in a third-person action-adventure game where you've got a character with as strong a personality and history as Lara, she has her own emotional state, right? And so we want to synchronize the player's emotional state with her so that you feel like you are with her, but not that you feel like you are her, because you're not. You're a very different person. And what we discovered during the process of development was that when players felt out of sync with Lara, everything about the game seemed less good. Like they would start to question even things that were excellent. They'd go like, "Meh," and not like them as much. Whereas when they were emotionally synchronized with Lara, even things that weren't yet polished in playtesting, people would start talking about how great they were.
Mm-hmm.
So we sort of hit on that as a key to making players feel really connected to what they were doing.
So the emotional synchronization became like that benchmark for you guys to kind of weigh things against it to see how successful it was going.
Yeah.
And this is one that I just think is like a fun term. So what is ludonarrative dissonance? Then?
Right. So ludonarrative dissonance is when the narrative, the way you feel from the narrative, based on the narrative, has dissonance with the way you play, the way you feel from the gameplay. Ludos being game.
So not good.
Yeah.
We want to avoid that.
We want to avoid ludonarrative dissonance and strive for emotional synchronization.
And I have to imagine that it's more difficult to get emotional synchronization in interactive media versus more traditional books and movies and so on. What are some of the unique challenges with that?
Yeah, well, so one of the things I talked about in the GDC talk was that there's some science behind the idea of synchronization between the storyteller and the person listening to a story. You can do functional MRA brain scans. Matt and Brandon are looking at me like, "Oh, interesting." No, but so there was this awesome paper that was in my talk that was talking about how if you do functional MRI scans of storytellers and listeners, you can actually see the parts of the brain of a storyteller and a listener lighting up in sync with each other. So if you have somebody telling a story about throwing a baseball, it's not just the linguistic centers that will light up. You could have a story of somebody throwing a baseball and the part of the premotor cortex that is about planning for the right arm will light up. And it will also light up in the listener. And what they found was the greater the degree of synchronization between brains, the greater the degree of recall later when people were asked to come back and recall details of the story that they listened to. So I found that really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But in an interactive medium, you have you don't have a passive listener. You have a player who can choose to make different choices than the character. Mm-hmm. And especially in a third-person action adventure game, there's this inherent distance that as a game designer, as a systems designer, I want to conquer that and try to bring you closer to what the character wants. And ideally do it in a way that's related to the gameplay, that's related to sort of my domain as a game designer. So based on the research that has to do with narrative, it's a given that if from a narrative perspective, Lara is going through something in the story, right? A person who's with her already in the story is going to care about the things that she cares about. Mm-hmm. But for the people who aren't with her emotionally, it's very elegant to be able to offer them incentives that make them want what she wants.
Yep.
Not because of the story. So that's the goal.
Okay. So obviously Tomb Raider's foundation was balanced between the three gameplay pillars that we mentioned, the smart, resourceful Lara, the traversal, and the combat. So we're going to walk through some of the systems that were integrated to make these, you know, the more meaningful experience, and how they evolved, keeping in mind that we wanted to have the player feel synchronized emotionally with Lara. So we'll start with Desperate Combat and the fluid cover system. So originally, there was not a cover system in Tomb Raider, correct? Why were we kind of hesitant to have cover early on in the game? Who wants to take this one?
You want me to, okay.
I'll take this one.
Go for it.
Excuse me. Cover in most games before Tomb Raider was a very static experience. Mm-hmm. And Tomb Raider is all about the movement. Lara's running around and she's agile. And so we always felt that cover would sort of violate that movement rule.
Mm-hmm.
And every game we'd seen kind of had that same problem. So everyone was very hesitant.
And what then were the factors that sort of made you guys realize, hey, maybe we do need to have a cover system? How did that evolve?
I think it was partly because we ended up having human enemies who had self-preservation in mind,
mm-hmm.
and they would take cover, and there were all these cover objects in the world that our enemies were using, and then it seemed odd that Lara would stand up behind a wall and get shot in the face.
Yes.
When any reasonable person would crouch down.
That is not a smart and resourceful Lara standing there.
Yeah, it feels very at odds with.
And when you say we had human enemies, that's because early on in the game, we did not have so many human enemies. There were a lot more this.
Very, very early on, it was a melee game, predominantly with very few weapons or ranged weapons at all. So that's really why it wasn't until, I'm bad with time, but a long time before we even had any archers in the game.
Yeah, it was very early. In the GDC talk, it's interesting, in Polygon did an article about my talk where they focused, like almost the whole article was focused on this issue of cover, which I thought was interesting. But I had slides in the GDC talk that showed the the old enemies with the little stabby claws jumping onto the horse and everything. So, and I was saying that we had started out as a ranged versus melee game with Lara backing up against, you know, these survival horror enemies.
Yeah, and we can touch on that in just a second, too, because we're going to look at the evolution of melee. But specifically with cover, then you kind of came to the realization that cover was needed. It didn't make sense for Lara to just kind of be standing there. What sorts of iterations of cover were explored? I mean, did we try the pop in, pop out at any point in time, or did it go straight to trying to get this fluid cover system, which turned out, as most people would say, quite fantastic?
Yeah, initially it was just going to be an animation overlay to make her look like she was crouching down. There was no functionality to it, but later on we decided to add the protection that you get behind it, and some of the other auto step back that she does if you do it near corners. But
but I remember some of the conversations we had about whether it should be pop in, pop out. Why did we not even prototype that? Why did we get straight to the fluid?
Do you remember? For the things that Gaston talked about earlier, we really wanted to make sure that, I think one of the terms that I think Bassan had thrown out in one of our meetings was that, you know, we wanted cover to be a path, not a destination,
mm-hmm.
And that like the button pop in really made it something you wanted to stay at. And as we talked about, it's about her agility. I think the combat loop is what assess, hit and run.
Yeah,
so mm-hmm. you want to be running all the time, and that's why our enemies also throw Molotovs to get you out of there. And
you had a button. You really can't hide behind any given space for too long. That's not a viable combat technique.
Yeah,
it's almost the opposite of what so many other shooters do, really.
Like, yeah, I play
where
a lot.
Find a good cover spot, kill everyone you can see, and then move on.
Yeah, yep. Wait for the chime that tells you the battle.
We don't
over.
Let you do that.
Yeah, and tying it back to this theme of emotional synchronization that we were talking about. What I said in the GDC talk was that, like, players have that perception that Lara's tactical advantage is her smaller size and her mobility, right? So we don't want the emotional feeling in the player that they're this big heavy infantryman staying put behind cover. We want them to feel what they expect her to feel, which is that she's got to assess hit and run and move. So that was that's how that ended up. That feature ended up in this context.
Great. We had touched on this briefly, and now we can kind of come full circle to it. Kind of like cover, melee was resisted for a while, or was it in the early implementation? You're saying it was almost entirely melee, but then it switched to ranged, and then it was reintroduced, or what was kind of like the timeline or evolution of that?
It seems
like there was a lot of back and forth.
Yeah, so
focus for sure.
We had the pickaxe pretty early in the project, and it's just such a cool weapon that melee ideas presented themselves. We actually had some pretty cool melee experiments that we didn't end up using in the final game, but then the emphasis went more on the bow and the ranged enemies, and there was a point in the middle of the project where people were saying, no melee at all, you know, nothing melee happens, and we soon realized that didn't work.
Yeah. Or we had there was a crazy in-between stage where we were like, okay, all right, we're going to make melee terrible at the beginning, and then all the great moves you'll buy. And they were like, wait a minute, no, then no one will buy
it. No one will invest into it then.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But you said also in the talk that there was a concern about melee being overpowered, which is something that's problematic in other games at times. So was that something that you guys had to balance to make sure that it wasn't, you know, just like all people defaulting to it instead of using a variety of weapons or moves?
Yeah, this hit you the most, Brandon. Like, we went back and forth where it's a game where we want players to feel like they can survive.
Yeah.
So we didn't want to have pistols that had infinite bullets. But if you don't have pistols that have infinite bullets, you need some way to kill people
if you have really bad aim.
Exactly.
Yeah, so. It was a very tough problem because we would have something that was effective and then players would want to use it all the time because she is so mobile.
Yeah.
And if it wasn't effective, then when they did run out of bullets, they hate the game.
Because
we also have melee guys that rush you, and if you are up close trying to shoot at a guy, it can be very, very difficult. And then added on top of that, you know, Lara isn't a very strong character physically, but she is agile. So anything we did with this axe, which was also very violent looking, if she was very effective with it, she basically became, you know, everything. She's not a very powerful, God of War-esque kind of character. So we had to try to find a characterization of that in animation that didn't seem overly powerful and functionally the same. It was very tough.
Yeah.
Which is something I'll throw a compliment your way quickly. We had a lot of fans really loved the melee animations and the animations for like the dirty tricks and so on because they felt very scrappy. And so you found like a nice balance between using her resourcefulness and not feeling like she's being too aggressive and so on.
That was a really big surprise for me, actually. So
that was my favorite thing. I unlock dirty tricks before anything else.
You know what I mean?
I just like doing it. It looks awesome.
Yeah, so I have to talk about that briefly. I lobbied for that move to go in, but I was concerned that no one would like it because it doesn't kill anybody, right? It's this sort of delaying thing. And it was really interesting how Bassan helped guide that into a really good place. Because there was this point in development where we had the dodging, you know, with the arrow to the knee and the arrow to the throat, right? And we also had this sequence of melee moves that that were called jump escape. That we ended up not. There were some of the skills that I mentioned in the talk that we didn't ship. And the problem was that they not only were they valid within the same context, like when the enemy is right up close to you. So when the enemy is really close to you, you could choose to jump escape or you choose to stab in the knee. Guess what you're going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to stab him in the knee. It's much more effective. And what was missing was something that was sort of at mid-range. We had guns that were useful at long range and melee that was useful at short range. And the dirty tricks was this thing that you could do against multiple enemies at mid-range. And I thought, well, I don't know if people are going to really like it. And I saw the same thing where people are like, were using it a lot and liked it.
So. It felt very Lara-esque, which is why they liked it. It felt like something, it felt scrappy and like something that someone would do in a moment of like, I just need another second, you know, this is what I'm going to do. And then you have your second to reassess or so on. So yeah, that was definitely something people liked.
Yeah. So
cool. Then we have, what was the final implementation of the melee combat and how did we, you know, make sure to balance it between being too heroic versus too violent?
We debated like whether we would give the player melee from the very beginning and or whether we would unlock it at a specific point and when that specific point mm-hmm. would be. And when we gave it from the very beginning, or like pretty much from the moment you get the axe, and people played the game, it wasn't really, first of all, it wasn't very useful. There was a very long period of time before they could upgrade it. And what would happen is players would sort of start testing it out and then kind of stop doing it. So it felt overpowered, but not really very incentivizing. And then they wouldn't mm-hmm. upgrade it. But when we finally found this sort of sweet spot for where it is right now, even though there are people who would want it sooner, there's with a lot of iteration, we sort of found like that moment is just the moment where they're kind of ready for a new tool.
Yeah.
And just as they start to experiment with it in combat, we have a lot of melee enemies rushing you. So then they feel incentivized to upgrade it. And I think through a lot of trial and error, we finally found like the right moment to unlock it that really gets people to use it a lot. I don't know. I mean, you saw a lot more of the playtest results than I did.
Yeah, because you said that the feedback loops were really important, specifically when it came to melee, correct? You had to just keep testing it with people and see where that sweet spot was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, initially it was a three-hit combo that what I guess really helped us get on the path of finding the right answer was when we started breaking it up into individual attacks. So I think you start off with just the shove, right?
And yeah.
Mm-hmm. The silver tier is just the single axe strike.
Yeah, yeah, and then you get the axe strike combo. So the one thing I wanted to add at the end was just that I think where we ended up with it was very cool. I told the anecdote in the GDC talk about how we added the little window of invulnerability when you're scrambling to keep your thumb closer to the B rather than the A, and what that did was it sort of incentivized people to sort of swap between the A and the B button, mm-hmm. which turned out to be absolutely critical to there being, I think, really good combat pacing in that you're sort of, you feel like you're using all of Lara's tools. You're not just shooting the bow. You're not just using melee. You're not just using one button. You're sort of cycling through all of the tools that she has to survive, which like exactly fits the kind of emotional feel that we want. So we use these low-level systems to incentivize the player to behave in such a way that brings them closer to how they expect Lara would feel, which is desperate and using all available
everything
tools.
Everything that she has to just get by the skin of her teeth.
And I wish we had done that like, you know, purely through planning, but it was a lot of iteration.
It took a while to get there.
You're much, much more intelligent than I am. I mean, having been part of those systems, I would never have been like, yeah, we put it on B so that the player's finger would be closer to A. That was...
No, we had... I just remember we had those conversations. I don't remember... You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm just painting a rosy picture of all the pain and suffering we went.
So next up, we have Smart Resourceful Valara, which I don't know how often we use this term externally, but this is like, you know... the puzzle solving and so on. Lara using her wits and her intelligence and her survival instincts and so on to assess situations, but that's what we refer to it. And so specifically it was gear-based interactions that you talked about in your speech. So you did a lot of exploring survival fiction and how tools equate to survival in these sort of settings. Do you want to speak to that at all?
Yeah, yeah. So my wife writes children's books. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of Newbery. She's been nominated for some Newbery Awards. We have a lot of other Newbery books around the house, and so I read a lot of them. There's one by Gary Paulson that's about a guy surviving in the wilderness with a hatchet. It's called Hatchet.
Has everybody read that?
Have you read that?
Like. That was, I had to read that in school, and I loved it.
Nice.
And the pilot scared me forever.
Totally. Yeah.
That was a really creepy thing for a kid to read, by the way. Anyway.
Well, so I read that when we were early in pre-production, because I did not have to read it in school. And you know, one of the first things he did was make a bow and try to survive. And it really, for me, it really sort of, all that research I did reading survival fiction underlined how important gear is to you. Mm-hmm. So when we were talking about wanting Lara to feel like a survivor, I was like, well, she has to feel emotionally connected to her gear. And if you compare that to like how in previous Tomb Raider games you would operate a switch or like solve puzzles, right? She operates everything with her hands. You know, everything's mm-hmm. just like, blah, my hands. So I thought, I lobbied to make every interaction in the game require gear. Like every switch that she encounters just happens to be stuck and she needs an axe to pry it. And every fire that she needs just happens to be out and she needs to light it. So I wanted to bring that idea of all the interactions requiring gear. And like they didn't, in the end we had like elevator buttons and things that didn't, but that dependence on gear, I think, is important to add to a survival feel. We use the axe as gating, not just for puzzles, but also like axe climb, right? You were the big proponent of axe climb as opposed to dice.
Well, I mean, yes, as it relates to that climbing, because it's more analog surface, so I think the axe climb just feels better, but that's more from just it just feels better on the sticks. An axe, character-wise, just felt better because how else is she going to climb these flat rocks? Now, granted, an ice axe you wouldn't use.
Yes, you guys are aware of that.
We take what we have.
Yeah, you take what you work with what you got, and if that's what she has. Yeah.
I mean, the axe, like we were talking about melee before, the only reason the axe exists is because the game was a melee game very early on. That's why mm-hmm. it was on her hip, so like we carry that over.
I don't remember if this was in... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say there was a push pretty early for this gear-gated opening up of new areas. Mm-hmm. You know, where we want to be able to come back sort of in a Batman Arkham Asylum style, come back to old areas and go to new places. And that sort of required gear as the key, in effect, to open up these areas. So we were just exploring how could every piece of gear become a gating item. Mm-hmm. So the bow, the shotgun, the axe, all of them mm-hmm. allow her to now get to places she couldn't get without that gear.
Specifically, when it comes to the axe, was there a period of time that Lara would climb with just her hands, or was it always used as a
yeah. only in the prototype?
Tool? There was going to be an axe or a wall surface you could climb with hands only, and then later on, again, come back to a different path that was required the axe. So yeah, mm-hmm. there was two.
Yeah,
for a while.
In fact, I think in her animation, it's called wall climb because there used to be an axe climb and a wall climb still.
Interesting to know. So yeah. one of the things that you did to have the player connect was actually the tools is making them feel like they were using the tools in gameplay and in the controls. So you want to speak to that concept?
Yes, that concept. So it's funny, like I in the GDC talk, I used this real highfalutin term, somatic mimesis. What I was trying to do with that was come up with a word that described what it was. So like the shorthand that Noah and I used, Noah, the creative director, Creative director of Tomb Raider, Noah Hughes. He called it onomatopoeia for the longest time.
Yeah.
Like, which was like, you know, like quack sounds like a duck or whatever. Yeah. But it wasn't onomatopoeia is about how something sounds.
Yeah.
And we wanted, I wanted a term for how something
parody
feels.
Parody for how it feels. Yeah. Okay.
So somatic mimesis is it copies the feeling you have in your body without being that actual thing. And the inspiration for that, at least for me, was Alan Wake. Mm-hmm. When Alan Wake came out, and we were working on it. There was that that thing where you're yanking a cord to like start a generator. And you know, I mowed a lot of lawns when I was a kid, so I know what that feels like. And that the sort of circular spinning UI element with a timed button press is nothing like yanking a cord to start a generator, but it felt just like it.
Yeah.
And so the idea was how to translate that to our game. And for me, like the thing that I most wanted was for using the torch to light objects, to feel like when you're lighting a birthday candle and you're holding that thing and you can stop and it hasn't lit yet and then you hold it and it smokes a little bit and then it finally catches. So we implemented that as a button hold mm-hmm. to you know, be like her holding the torch against the flammable thing. That might be damp or not damp. If it's damp, it takes longer. And then the other one was the pry mechanic with the mm-hmm. button mash. Button mashes are annoying and tiring, but you know, prying something open requires effort. So coming up with a nice balance between something that does make you feel like a moment of effort versus making it too annoying to ship as a game was kind of balance.
And were there any of those sorts of features that you cut? I got a kick out of this one.
There were a couple more that he didn't talk about. I mean, the bow was the first one we had where the very first implementation of bow was just like a pistol. You pull the trigger and an arrow shoots.
Yeah.
And then we realized that naturally you had to swap it around and, and pull the trigger and release. Which made it work differently from all other weapons, but in a very...
In a great way
that people like.
There's so many people that say, oh, the bow just feels good. And it's amazing how a button press and hold can feel so good, but it does.
And we built on it over time so that like you couldn't hold it forever and it would shake and things like that.
There's a lot of subtlety to that, actually, because we iterated on that where if you hold it for too long, we tried a camera shake. And you know the camera shake would shake for a while and then you'd release. But that was incredibly annoying for somebody who was holding it until the last second.
Yeah, so, to try to be accurate.
Yeah, so what ships is not a camera shake. It's what it is the outer circle of the reticle jiggles.
Yeah.
The center dot of the reticle does not jiggle, and the camera does not jiggle. And that gives you the sensation of this sort of loss of accuracy without an actual loss of accuracy.
That's interesting.
Yeah. There's another one that possibly people didn't notice. I think it was too subtle and only happens in the final boss fight against the big stalker guy.
Yeah.
When you get him down on the very final kill, everyone go back, play again, and try this. When you hit that button to whack him on the head, she'll swing her axe when you hit the button, as long as you don't do it too fast.
Yeah.
So you can pause, and her arm will move when you hit the button, which when you... do it and you know it's there, it's very gratifying.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's really hard to communicate because we didn't do that anywhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah.
Have to go back and even I'll have to go back and that. Not that I need another excuse to play, but... And even when... Is it similar when Lara's reaching for her bow the first time and how you have that control with reaching, pressing the stick to reach? I think whenever we would demo the game, I would actually reach out a little bit and pull my hand back or I'd intentionally miss so that people... would realize that it wasn't just a cutscene. But little details like that definitely help keeping players in control the whole time.
Yeah, so like even the opening sax swing, right? We debated on whether it should be a quick time event like, you know, primarily animated, right? Lord knows that would have been easier, right, Brandon, if it was like the whole thing was animated. You know.
It is.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
It's worse.
Yeah, it's worse. Well, you've got all of the blends, but I mean, like, it gives you that feeling of pumping your legs on the swing because it's actually driven by physics and pumping the stick.
So what was the one, we'll go back, what was the one that was taken out of the game that you mentioned?
So I mentioned in the talk the body search that we did in Vertical Slice 1 where you had to, that one.
You were sticking your hands into a pile of
the sack search,
of something.
And it was just
It was sort of a two-stick control, and you were trying to like
things around. And
yeah, you'd get a rumble when you had the stick in the right zone, but you had to get them both lined up at the same time, and then she would find the prize.
Yeah, it was sort of like borrowing the Arkham Asylum hacking mechanic, where you have like two sticks working independently with a sweet spot, but we had recontextualized it, which is sort of Tomb Raider speak for. How we fictionalized something. Contextualization was a buzzword with us. So we recontextualized the Arkham Asylum mechanic as a sort of searching for loot.
I'd imagine that just kind of looked a little awkward, like she's doing some sort of interpretive dance or something while feeling piles of stuff.
That is one of the reasons it never made it.
It was a really good cut. And it kind of, it survived a little bit in searching corpses. There was an early iteration where after you killed a guy, you had to hold a button like Assassin's Creed to get the ammo and salvage out of him. But it didn't fit our combat pacing. So that became a very quick button tap.
All right, so let's move on to survival skills then. We added some light RPG elements to the game, which was obviously, I think, was one of the things that was most surprising to people when they first heard about it. So how does this lend itself to the sort of, again, the emotional synchronization and sort of, I guess, Lara unlocking her potential by unlocking skills?
Yeah. So there are there was an easy win there and then a lot of hard work. Mm-hmm. So the easy win was that we wanted... I just realized that I've been shaking the arms to my chair this whole time. Anyway, so there was an easy win and then a lot of hard work. And the easy win was that if you want players to feel emotionally invested in the character growth of somebody, then when you let them choose how to grow the character, they're going to be emotionally invested mm-hmm. in their choices. So the idea of adding those RPG late mechanics, very much inspired by, you know, irrational games and that whole school of game design, mm-hmm. where you have action games with RPG, light RPG elements. God of War too, right? Mm-hmm. You choose what upgrades you buy for Kratos. Was definitely the right thing for us, but we had a sort of very high bar in terms of how we wanted the player to feel at certain points in her character growth arc. So all of the work was in figuring out a way for the player to still feel like they had adequate choice as the game progressed, but not really allowing them to make choices that would undermine that. So mm-hmm. we couldn't let them buy a skill that stabs enemies in the throat through their helmet, right?
As their second skill.
Right? Yeah. Right, as their second skill, and then
That's a quick arc.
Exactly. And then you have a cinematic where she's like, oh, I'm Roth. I'm not sure what to do. You know, what can I don't know if I can make it.
And then he says, stab him in the face and solved, right?
Right. Problem solved. And so there was a lot of debate there, like should we just lock a bunch of things arbitrarily and then say, okay, player, you've reached chapter 3. Now you may buy these skills. Mm-hmm. And it was definitely a goal of mine to always push the idea of player choice, where sort of a more elegant solution that solves that problem is sort of investment-based unlocking. So that was an idea that I borrowed from Borderlands, where the more you invest in a particular skill tree, the more it opens up choice. Mm-hmm. So buy any skills in this set, and it unlocks the next tier, and now you have a lot more choice, and buy any skills in this tier and open up the full choice. Mm-hmm. That's how we ended up with that design, and it still gave us the degree of control we needed because we, as game designers, know how many experience points are in the game. So we could make sure that if the seventh skill was something we wanted to delay, mm-hmm. We could just make sure that there weren't enough experience points prior to the point in the game where it was okay for her to stab people in the throat.
Yeah.
Not permit her to be able to level up far enough to buy yep. that skill. And then beyond that, they might buy that as the first skill in the next tier, or the last skill in the next tier, or they might never buy it.
Mm-hmm. One thing I thought was really interesting is that you said that at first there was an attempt to include traversal skills, but that made jumping a little complicated. One of you guys kind of speak to that?
Yeah, you've got a lot of experience with that, Matt. You should take that.
Yeah, I mean, traversal and intramurator is always a very tricky issue to balance.
Yep.
But when it becomes variable, like especially when you're talking jumping,
yeah.
it's a harder problem for level designers and a harder problem for players because they can't look at a jump and go, okay, that's clearly something I can do or it's clearly something I can't because I can jump 2 feet further than I used to be able to. And players can't perceive depth very well.
Because mm-hmm. Originally, like the idea was to make it upgrades are where she could jump farther or so yeah. on. But it makes the environment very...
Well, we looked for
evaluate.
Upgrades. Yeah, we looked for upgrades in all the mechanics, but jumping is sort of the obvious one that people are doing all the time. But we talked about faster climbing, which I guess did ship because it didn't change much.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's, you know, different kinds of like jumping on ledges, maybe further or faster, which we didn't do. So every mechanic we tried to think of things that could upgrade, but for the most part, they just kind of broke the game.
Yeah.
Even just running a little faster changes pacing, and then we have to worry about things loading before the player gets mm-hmm. there, technical issues that make everything harder to design levels.
Yeah, plus it, you know, it has the potential to make the game more boring, right? Because if you speed up the player's run speed, right? And you don't know whether they've bought that skill or not, right? You have to design your streaming connectors to be the length they have to be for the fast-running player. Mm-hmm. And then the slow-running player has this really long streaming connector that they don't even need because their character can't run very fast.
And then you can't design challenges around that. Like, if somebody had a longer jump skill, you can't mm-hmm. design a part of the game that requires that skill.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that skill actually doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can imagine there's a lot of iteration and thought that went into that. That one sounds particularly complicated. All right, next up is Salvage. So how was Salvage sort of born into this world? And why was the decision made to try to avoid like actual currency and buying upgrades?
Yeah, that was interesting. So survival skills came first.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think the fans would be kind of interested to hear that, like, we weren't even sure the survival skills were going to make it. I think, like, one of my first prototypes of XP
mm-hmm.
Was enemies would drop these red physics balls that would bounce around.
Hmm.
And it felt very gamey and God of War, like the rage that you get, you know.
You'd hold a button and they'd all come into you.
Exactly.
Magnetically.
Yeah, yeah. And and so that almost didn't make it, but it did. But make it, it did. And then, it started to feel a little abstract.
Mm-hmm.
A survival experience and these sort of survival skills. So I started to be a little uneasy with the choice space that was going to make sense with that fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of the salvage upgrades that shipped, you could fictionalize as a survival skill, like more accuracy with your bow,
mm-hmm.
faster firing rate. Maybe she's just smarter and has more experience.
Yep.
But so there was a point in development where it sort of felt like that survival skills were too abstract.
Mm-hmm.
So as in, even though we could have fictionalized faster firing rate and more damage and more accuracy as a skill that Lara was learning, it felt like a combat-focused player wasn't going to be incentivized to explore because you don't know where the experience points are in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like mostly experience points are located on enemies. I would like to move forward and shoot more enemies and get my XP, right?
Yep.
But we wanted players to explore the world. So I was thinking about how in Dead Space you have these stores throughout the world,
mm-hmm.
and you have money, and you can convert stuff into money, and money into weapon upgrades,
mm-hmm.
and money into ammo, and ammo that you find for a gun that you don't want back into money. And it was good to have an economy of stuff. So I sort of felt like we want that. We need that,
mm-hmm.
right? But then how to fictionalize it in a survival context. And the one that seemed to fit better was the campsite as the store.
Mm-hmm.
And then random stuff that she finds, which we ended up calling salvage, as the currency. So it is very much a sort of currency and store system. But it's fictionalized in a way that makes Lara feel resourceful and
mm-hmm.
and incentivizes exploration. And I felt I pounced on Dan Neuberger on his first day on the project. I'd been like, this had been bothering me, and I'd been talking to Noah about it a little bit. And then Neuberger joined the project. It was like literally his first day. He had no idea who I was, and I had this whole spec for salvage, and I like pounced on him. I was like, we have to do this, and he was like, hi.
Hi. Hello.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say that some of this came forward from the concept of having animals on the island,
mm-hmm.
which we knew we wanted to do to make the island feel alive and not just like this weird void place.
Yeah.
So we had animals, and we're like, well, if we have animals, people are going to want to shoot them. And
yeah.
Shooting them's kind of cool and fun, but then there's just dead animals.
You're
going to
feel
everywhere.
Like a jerk if you don't get something out of it. And you're
yeah.
Just
so then
animals.
We're like, well, okay, killing animals is kind of fun, so let's reward them for doing that. But we don't really have a food mechanic, and we talked about it, but ultimately we didn't go that way. So we wanted you to be able to get something from the animals that you could use.
Mm-hmm.
And so salvage, partly as a term, came out because we're like, well, the animals aren't full of metal.
Yeah.
Though I saw a forum post where somebody thought they were. It's that she makes stuff out of leather and bone and
yes.
not just metal scraps.
And sinew yeah. and
yes.
yeah, antlers.
And once we had that, we're like, well, okay, that means salvage can be other stuff, not just the animals, and that... led
it's
to the
It's a
crates.
Nice semi-ambiguous term. Like, yeah. it can incorporate quite a bit.
Yeah. So salvage just represents you find things that you can make stuff out of to provide a second currency besides experience.
Yeah.
I liked that that was a choice that you made as a survival skill to say, I would like to use the whole animal, you know, because it really sort of, it makes players who sort of care about that sort of thing feel like they're not slaughtering the animals just for fun, but they're trying to use the whole animal in a respectful way. And,
yeah.
You know, gets the food value and the...
being considered.
I'm going to make better grenades out of this deer. Yeah, exactly.
This is the best deer ever. We're moving on to the last tier, which is a traversal and exploration. And I like in this one, Jonathan, you said that there was some easy wins, which it doesn't seem like there was a lot of easy wins in this game. You guys had to work really hard to fine-tune these mechanics. But you said air steering was kind of an easy win when it came to the emotional synchronization.
I characterized the air steer was all you, right, Brandon? But just for context, because you weren't at my talk, I characterized it in terms of a pre-calculated jump, like everybody else does, it's easy to make look really good, but the player essentially is ignoring the stick while they're in the air. Right, so whereas players have this feeling in their gut that if they hold the stick forward, it's like, oh, I can make that extra jump. Or
like when you sit down with a controller and you're jumping and you're moving around.
Yeah, exactly. Or if they make a jump, or if they start a jump and they're like, oops, I didn't mean to do that. And they go, whoa, and they pull the stick back. You know, in Mario, that works. That Mario listens to you. And in most third-person action-adventure games, the player doesn't listen. Right, and you like just gut level. When I joined the project in 2008, you were like, "No, we want to do air steer, even if it's going to make your job more difficult." You know, animating it to look awesome. So I talked about that. So you want to enlarge on that?
I don't know if we did it because of the emotional connection, but that's probably
a nice side effect.
You can land that, but it just feels better, right? So that as the captain of the player and enemy team, my main focus is trying to make sure that on the sticks, the game felt as good as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And past two meters had that once you press the jump button, you are going to make it or you're not. And that, even playing the game a few weeks ago, actually, the older game's Legend, I think, it's just incredibly frustrating to make a jump. You think you're going to make it, and then you realize...
Nope.
You know, her animation didn't play the right one that you're used to seeing, and you die.
Yeah.
And this just allowed you to survive, to make a mistake, but pull back or left or right to find your destination. So.
And what were some of the concerns with animation? Because it's more difficult to animate air steering.
Well, when you predict that you're going to actually land on the ledge, we can play a can animation that looks absolutely beautiful.
You know what's going to happen, yeah.
With air steer, we're at the mercy of the player who... I mean, if you watch demos on YouTube, you can see people do, even now, obviously make Lara look absolutely atrocious. And we have people on the team that are very good at that to show us the flaws in our systems, even as we think they're very good. But, you know, again, because the player can do whatever they want.
So you have to sacrifice a little bit of control to give the players that sort of agency. But it seems like they appreciate it. I do know that the air steering was very much when people saw, we demo it, and we were like, look at this. And they were just like, yes. So I think it is something that was appreciated.
That's very cool.
And there were fun things we could do with it, too. We didn't get a lot of this in the shipped game, but we could do things like jumping on stepping stones across a river. But because you could steer in the air, it meant you didn't have to have the stick in just the perfect position before jumping.
You could course correct slightly.
You could sort of naturally correct, whereas in a pre-targeted jump system, if you hit that button and your thumb was still moving...
Splash.
We don't know where you're going. You know, we go where you had your stick at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also talked about Animgraph, which was something that you two worked a lot with. You know, in previous Tomb Raider, it's like some of the fans love this level of detail. Which
they do.
And I know this because I was a fan prior to working here.
And because you lurk on the boards.
Yes, and I lurk on the boards. I do. Right, on Legend, you guys have been with the studio. I joined for this project, whereas Matt and Brandon both you have been around since Legend, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, right?
Long before, yeah.
So, So prior to this, I saw the tools change. Prior to this, we didn't have Animgraph, right? And I think, I mean, I'd love to hear you talk about whether you could have achieved the level of character performance with air steering if you hadn't had Animgraph. Oh,
I think you need to explain what Animgraph is.
Yeah, you should explain what Animgraph is versus what you had before.
Well, the short answer is absolutely not. We couldn't have done it. But Animgraph is I might need Gaston on this one too, but it's a way of putting more power in the animator's hands to combine, just like combine animations and blend animations together.
Yeah. I mean, as many levels as you want, really.
As many levels on different bone sets, so maybe just want an animation on the arm or just the eyes.
Wow.
For instance, Lara's idol, there's a different overlay just for her eyes and her blinks than there is for her mouth and for her body and for overall, like, an overlay on top of that. So it allows us to get a lot of animation that doesn't look like it's looping or cycling every 30 frames, even though it's made up of a lot of smaller animations that kind of give hopefully the impression that she is alive. I guess as it concerns the air steering, I guess that one was kind of a simple blend, so we may have been able to do it, but it would have been a lot of like, Gaston, here's kind of what we need. He would go away into his fancy castle, come back with
magic.
Something, then we'd iterate on a much slower, much slower timeline.
Yeah. Whereas Animgraph, it's like a visual scripting language for animators to create a hierarchical state machine as deep as they want of animations on different bone sets. It's
nice.
It's awesome. Well, I love it.
No,
it's a good tool.
It is.
Sounds like you're an Animgraph advocate.
Yeah. Well, Brandon and I worked really closely on a lot of Animgraph related systems, and I pushed him to allow Lara to have pistol in one hand and torch in the other. Which
I like that one. I like that one.
Which
I'm not a fan of the
Yeah.
All right, so the last gameplay mechanic we're gonna talk about then, the gameplay system, is the reach reversal and fast travel. And the interesting thing about this is that, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was mostly motivated by collectibles. Having those included and being able to re-explore areas to find things that you maybe would have missed.
Collectibles were a tool for it. I mean, I think the biggest motivation was, we build these huge spaces that a player who chooses to pursue the story, and it's a compelling story where it's always like, hurry, so-and-so's going to die, or we have
Sam,
to...
Sam, Lara, come get me, and I'm like, no, but I'm going to go over here, sorry.
Yeah, exactly. So the player who, the style of player who's really into the story isn't going to explore all these spaces, so collectibles were sort of a key system that incentivized that.
Yep.
But I think... On a deeper level, if we're going to talk about reach reversal for 1 second, if you have a game with survival skills, right, or with upgrades, then you sort of have to make a choice about whether the world is going to be so full of experience points that the player who just pursues the linear path is bound to like find a whole bunch of them, and then there isn't much incentive for the player who's going to explore, because in an action adventure game. There can be a situation where you pass by this nook and there's a little collectible in it that has experience points on it, you know, and then you'll be like, okay, hang on 1 second. I'm not going to pick that up. I see that, but I just want to see what's through this door here. And then shkaboom, the door slams, things light on fire, there's a bunch of explosions, and you're in a combat setup. And that's really unfair to that player, because if they don't have a way to, other than to... restart the game from a previous checkpoint or play the game from the beginning again, they don't have a way of staying connected with the character that they built and the skills that they built and still find that collectible, which open world games do really well. You can play them and still be connected to that version of Ezio that you made, or that version of Batman that you made, and still get all the collectibles. So reach reversal, it was more, I guess the reason I'm stressing this is that it's more like collectibles were the cart, but the emotional connection to Lara was the horse, rather than the other way around.
Okay.
Anyway.
So. A quick aside, I know we're talking particularly about fast travel, but I do think that this is interesting as collectibles. How did you find different ways to motivate players to be kind of completionists? Because I thought this was interesting collectibles as sets, displaying the full catalog. There's like these little tricks you can do that incentivize people to dig more and to find more.
Yeah, there are a lot of rules about how to make, how to grab different sets of people. Like me personally, I'm very much I'm very narrative driven. Mm-hmm. I married a writer, you know, whatever. But when people come up to me, there have been people who come up to me and say, I love the challenges. I love how the challenges weren't on the map. And I loved like blowing up all the you know, sea mines or lighting all the statues or whatever. And it always surprises me because that isn't what incentivizes me, but it's clearly the thing that incentivized them the most. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important to have, you know, things to destroy, things that have story in them, things that have exploration. I really worked hard to make sure that we had the feature where you look underneath the mask and it's got a price tag on it.
Yeah.
And like find details in there and really feel like someone trained as an archaeologist, mm-hmm. you know, examining an artifact. So that's part of it. Catalogs is important. I learned that lesson playing Katamari Damacy, mm-hmm. which is not a game about collecting until you go to the menu and you can sort of see the full catalog of all the things that exist in the world that you've picked up on your rolling ball. And then it just makes you want to replay levels.
You have to find them all.
Yeah, over and over and over again to complete the catalog.
Are you guys collectors? Do you collect when you play?
Well, in this game, definitely. Like, I usually like to collect, but if it gets too difficult or if there's no incentive, I get tired and I don't want to do it. But I think Jonathan sort of hit on a point when he said, you know, it caters to different people's styles. And I think that's part of it, right? We make a beautiful world because we want to make a beautiful world. Mm-hmm. We have a story that only goes through a track on it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we want people who appreciate the world to go look around and feel like they can. Mm-hmm. But then we want them to feel like it was worth it and not get frustrated or bored.
Yeah.
So we put stuff in there for them. And like Jonathan said, there's different rewards. The story, like in this one, I really, like, even though I thought I knew the story of the game, once those collectibles with all the stories went in there, I was really interested in finding out more. You can learn about Lara's companions and all of the main enemies she faces. And these are story bits that, as a developer, I didn't know until I collected the collectibles.
Yeah, I loved the journals were the main things that I always went after. But it's really funny because people in the forums are like, Lara is so nosy. She walks up and she's reading everybody's journals. And we're like, yeah, it's funny. Yeah. But it provided such awesome insight. The challenges were really fun, too. The ones in the geothermal caverns got me. One of those sacks you had to burn.
Yeah.
Could not find it forever. And I just walked around looking and I could not find it. And I finally did. And I was like, how did I miss it?
My favorite one of those is just so devious is the flag that you have to burn with the fire arrow on the crane on the roof of the coastal.
I'm not going to lie. I YouTubed that one. I couldn't find it. Because I played through the game a couple of times before release, obviously. And not joking, I put in an extra 5 hours trying to 100%, and then someone told me afterwards that not all of the challenges were in. Oh, and I was like, are you kidding me? I've been just running around looking for them. So then I didn't know going into the release version where everything was.
The dream catcher that's sort of out of the exploration area.
It's through a window. Yeah. You guys put some rough ones in there. Yeah. But I did feel pretty darn accomplished when I got it.
Yeah. There is a secret document, which is we had to prepare for QA, because QA had a person specifically assigned to make sure that it was possible 100%.
Yeah.
So we had to give that person like a document saying where everything is. So we had to constantly maintain that document as we sort of moved things around and make sure that they had a sort of an itemized list.
Yeah.
So there's one other sort of secret to sort of attracting people that I wanted to share, which was it's the systems design equivalent of putting something on sale, mm-hmm. in a way. Where like you're like, I don't know if I really want to buy those things. But then if it goes on sale, you're like, okay, I'll buy it, right? But and that was the treasure maps, which almost didn't make it. So but what's so yummy about those is that if you're the kind of person who, you know, if you know where something is, you'll be willing to go search it out.
But hardcore fans wouldn't buy it.
Right.
But then that's fine because they don't have to.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That's a treasure map. I'll find it on my own. But no, it is great for those last couple of ones that you.
Yeah,
you
I mean, some of the hardcore players sometimes complain about those help systems like maps or even Survival Instinct or the ledge coloration issues. But, you know, we're making a game for everyone. Yeah. And so we try and make those opt in as much as possible so that the people who just want to have a fun, easy, light experience
can
get all that help. And the hardcore players
can just ignore
avoid
it.
Yeah, it's true. We talk about those as opt-in mechanics all the time. Like Survival Instinct, if you don't like it, just don't hit the button. You know, so.
Yeah. All right, so we were talking about fast travel, but I thought that was an interesting aside. So, you know, I'll be totally honest. I didn't necessarily notice this at first, that there's a difference between the two types of camps. So do you want to speak to those and why two types of camps was necessary?
Yeah, wow.
It's kind of that's a complex question.
It is. There was a lot of tension during the process between design goals. Sorry, tension between design goals. That's like tension is the word that we use as designers to refer, like, you want your cake and you want to eat it too, right? So there's design tension between eating the cake and having it. So there was a lot of design tension between the goal of making sure that the player felt connected to the forward experience, but also giving them the ability to collect and explore without you know, there being a post-game like treasure hunter mode or something like that. And so there were definitely areas of the game that we considered like non-reach-reversible areas, the OMS areas.
When everything explodes, it makes sense for you to not be able to get back there.
Exactly, right. And if you're in an area where we want you to enjoy that roller coaster gameplay, we want to communicate to you very clearly that that there's nothing to find here. There are no collectibles here. There's no point in sort of standing still in the cliffs of insanity and waiting as long as possible before we, you know, make the house fall just in case there's a collectible there. So so one of the ways we communicated that was through the map. I mean, it says very clearly there are no collectibles here, so don't look, you know, just enjoy the roller coaster. But there was tension between that and these very long sequences that were roller coaster. And you have all of these resources that you're just dying to spend on an upgrade, or you're dying to buy a survival skill because you didn't at the last camp. So we wanted to start putting camps around. So we had to figure out how to explain to players, okay, here's a camp where we just want you to upgrade your stuff, and here's a camp where it's okay to explore. And what I said in the talk at GDC is, like, I wish we had hit on this two camps idea a lot sooner. We tried like all these various rules of I'm lost right now, and so I can't even think about like upgrading my skills, I can't even remember all the different versions we had of rules.
But just ways to communicate the differences between the two.
Yeah, there are these code systems that Matt built, right, or that the herd team built. I guess it might have been you or Ted, involving like the state of a region.
So the region could be, you know, not yet visited at all. It could be, you know, I'm in it, but I don't know where I am. For like cases where she falls out of a helicopter and is in the middle of nowhere, and then it's like, okay, I know where I am now, but I can't go back just yet. And then
The final. But I can't go back yet just yet because the story doesn't want me to go back just yet. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, it ended up being like much too complicated. And the simplest thing was, if you come on a camp of a certain type, you can go anywhere you've been previously.
And those are the ones that have like the little knapsacks, and they look more established, correct?
Yeah, they've got a sleeping roll, and there's a ring of rocks around the camp, and it's supposed to sort
of... Basically says it's okay to chill out here.
Right, and there's like the icon is there's a little tent, you know, so you can sleep here. And then the sort of upgrade store camp is more makeshift. There's no ring of rocks. I think it's just this fire is smaller. There's more smoke curling up from the fires. It's a smokier fire. And I think we didn't do as good a job as we could have, because I get that a lot of people didn't notice the difference between the two camps. So we definitely could have done better to distinguish them. I think we did a great job on the map with the two different icons. But I really wanted players to go like, oh, okay, here I am at a base camp. And they didn't really get that so much.
Did anyone figure out the campfire meat?
Campfire meat?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if anybody did. Yeah.
I think it was just subconscious. Because, like, I notice these things when you say them. But you did definitely when you come to a base camp where you can stay in fast travel. You get a feeling of it being less transitory. Like, you can stay there and rest. And the beat in the story usually feels like you can take a breath.
Yeah.
Whereas it made sense, like, in the geothermal caverns. I was like, no, I don't really think I need to fast travel out of here. Like, you know. I'm in this space and it's tense and I just need to escape from here and then I can take a break.
Yeah. Plus you only have your bow. I mean, that was the one place where the rule broke down a little bit because we wanted you to be able to get back to geothermal caverns. It had so much exploration in it, but you only have your bow. So what does that mean in story? Are you going to go back? And anyway, you're trapped here. You don't know how you got in. So
yeah.
How do you get out? It's kind of demonstrates that any design rule that you ever have, you has to be flexible when you're telling a story, you know. So
I have to say something really quick. I kind of made me laugh. Even if you wanted those OMS moments, people to know that there was nothing hidden, there was no objects, and even if it showed up on the map, I died so many times because I'm just like, I just want to look, and things would be falling around me. Because, like, there is this little bit of me that wanted something to be unlisted and hidden so that I felt like the ultimate Tomb Raider. And so, like, in the middle of everything burning down around me, I was still running around looking in every corner. It's just kind of like a base Tomb Raider fan instinct that's kind of hard to ignore sometimes.
It is. It's hard.
But then I think I would have I would have been mad if I missed something. So I totally understand what you guys did. It's just funny that sometimes training from past Tomb Raider experiences overrides you.
Like, I sometimes wish that we had sort of the post-destruction path available, but that's
we
more
talked
work
to them.
And we never...
Yeah, we didn't. Like, if I had infinite resources, like, you'd be able to go back to that den at the beginning and there'd be a version of it. Or
You get to kind of see what damage you've done.
Yeah, or go back to the cliffs and there's just a little, like, goat path under where all the destroyed buildings are.
That hut, after you finish all the cliffs, like, breaking down and stuff, there's a little upstairs space that was ideal for collectibles.
Mm-hmm.
And the level designers kept wanting to put collectibles in there. And I had to keep saying, like, you can't get back there.
Yeah.
You can't put a collectible. I think we ended up putting some salvage up there.
Yeah.
You know, because that economy was, because you could get it off animals, that had a little bit more wiggle room in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
that was a good middle ground, though, because I felt, you know, I went out of my way to try to get any type of salvage I could find, too. So it's, like, not imperative, but it's still something that you'd be like,
yeah.
I thought you could kind of go back there.
You couldn't, no.
No?
No. We ended up removing that. Yeah, so that's the other thing, is there was a lot of flux during development about what would be a reachable space and what wouldn't. We wanted to give the fans the largest possible footprint that we could for retraversability, but there were some streaming issues that made that more difficult than we could solve.
So the takeaway from this is game design is hard. Video games are hard to make.
Yes.
I think that we've expressed that thoroughly in past podcasts also. There is a lot more going on than people realize. So any final thoughts as we wrap up? Any other systems or stories or things that you had to take out that you wish had made into the final game?
Can I talk about crab cakes?
Yes, talk about crab cakes.
Oh, and the completionist thing. I mean, the game's been out long enough. I think I can talk about what happens when you get all the GPS caches. So,
yeah.
Okay. So
okay, I'm going to put a little spoiler mark here just in case any of you guys have not 100% stop listening now.
Cool.
Okay, go ahead.
Awesome. Yeah, so this didn't end up in the GDC talk because it's too, like...
Yeah, it's a good reward, but it's on the internet now. Yeah. Like, there's videos of it.
Yeah. So what I wanted to tell people, the podcast audience, was I'm a huge Tomb Raider fan. It was a dream of mine to work at Crystal Dynamics that I finally got to live, which was very cool. So there was stuff that I really wanted to do for the former me who didn't work here, and one of them was there was so much talk about Fifi the crab.
Yes, on the forums.
Yeah, I wanted to get special dispensation to have an achievement, which mentioned Fifi in Beach Hub. So when you shoot a crab, it's you know, it gives
crab
you
cake.
Yes, crab
cake. And it
cakes.
Says kill Phoebe the crab. The funny thing is that that was supposed to be a secret achievement, mm-hmm. but one of the websites put up the full list of achievements. So fans knew about the Phoebe achievement. And so they thought it was a special crab. And so before the game shipped, everybody was like, where do you think they're going to put Phoebe? How are we going to be able to tell that Phoebe's a special crab? And I'm sorry, but every crab is Phoebe.
Yes, yes. Or so. The first crab that you kill.
The first crab that you kill happens to be is Phoebe. Every time. Yeah. Just happens that yeah. way.
So the other thing that I sought special dispensation for. So my wife, who I've mentioned, wow, I keep mentioning her. But so she and I met around about when Tomb Raider 1 was out on the PS1, mm-hmm. And I was playing it at our mutual friend's house, and she found the sound effect that Lara back then played very amusing. Where she would like bend down and pick up, I guess it was the little statues, or maybe it was any item.
Her little aha.
Aha. And so it became this joke in our household whenever we were looking for something like, you know, where'd you put the salt shaker? And you'd open up a cabinet and whoever finds
it. The little
chime. Aha. So it was, so when we moved here from the East Coast and I was going to work at Crystal Dynamics, she said, you have one mission, which is to get aha into the game, and there was design tension between that goal and you know our desire to reinvent Lara and have a sort of a break from the past, but I went and sought approval so that I could put in a little Easter egg so that if you collect all of the GPS caches, mm-hmm. you get bring aha, and it's not a reused version of that
it's
sound
Camilla.
Effect. It's Camilla. We asked Camilla. We played it for Camilla, and we asked her to, like, you know, imitate it so that it would be sort of classic. Aha, Lara. And then there's other rewards that you get, intrinsic rewards in the systems of the game that you get for doing that for the fans, for the not fans who have no idea,
yeah. you know. Why she's so excited about this particular
yeah.
cache.
Yeah.
But that was definitely one that was appreciated. When I finally got to hear it, I was very excited.
Yeah. When I got the retail copy and I played it at home to 100% it, when I got to that point, I did a little video of it. And then I was going to post it to Facebook, but it was so early that I didn't want to.
It took a little while for people to get to that. And by a little while, I mean like a day for some of the more intense fans. But it took a bit. I like that, though.
There's one emotional synchronization moment that I don't think we talked about, and it was kind of subtle. It was getting the animals to look at you when you scare them.
You totally.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a nice touch.
Yeah, hunting sort of came in a little late on the project, so we didn't want to make it this necessary thing. And I know some people wanted it to have more value, but really it was just supposed to be this Zen experience, makes the world feel alive. And if you want to feel like you're hunting and surviving, you can hunt all you want, and there's plenty of animals to go around. So really the idea was just to have the animals wander around, they eat and they drink, and they get scared. And one of the ways, you know, the feedback moment of, hey, you've been spotted, is the deer perks his head up and looks at you, a classic mm-hmm. kind of deer moment. But there are people, you know, I've seen some forum topics about people not wanting to kill the animals.
As soon as
for
it
that
looks at
reason.
You, he's like, no, yeah, it's seen me.
So you can get the little rabbits to look at you. I guess technically the crabs do, but who can tell?
Yeah.
But yeah, that is like a moment that's its primary purpose is like that emotional connection, kind of make you feel like this world is alive. Yeah. And in a sense, you're emotionally synchronizing with the deer, mm-hmm. much like a hunter might have to do.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to figure out if you can overcome that.
Yeah.
And there's some people that can't, that don't hunt at all after
luckily,
the first
it's not really
required. Animal kill. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any final words for you, Brandon?
I'm afraid I'm dry.
All right. I think that's a good line to end on. All right, gentlemen. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's an hour and 20-minute podcast. I think we did pretty well.
Nice.
So I'll let you guys get back up to work.
Cool.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
And that is it for this episode of the Crystal Habit Podcast. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this segment. If you have an idea, if there's a topic you want us to explore and so on, feel free to send an email to community@crystald.com. And we'd love to hear from you. Till next time.